Keep the Aspidistra Flying by George Orwell. Chapter 2. Gordon walked homeward against the rattling wind, which blew his hair backward and gave him more of a good forehead than ever. His manner conveyed to the passers-by, at least he hoped it did, that if he wore no overcoat, it was from pure caprice. His overcoat was up the spout for 15 shillings, as a matter of fact. Willowbed Road, N.W., was not definitely slummy, only dingy and depressing. There were real slums hardly 5 minutes' walk away. Tenement houses where families slept 5 in a bed, and when one of them died, slept every night with a corpse until it was buried. Alleyways where girls of 15 were deflowered by boys of 16 against leprous plaster walls. But Willowbed Road itself contrived to keep up a kind of mingy, lower-middle-class decency. There was even a dentist's brass plate on one of the houses. In quite 2/3 of them, amid the lace curtains of the parlour window, there was a green card with apartments on it, in silver lettering, above the peeping foliage of an aspidistra. Mrs. Wisbeach, Gordon's landlady, specialised in single gentlemen. Bed sitting rooms, with gaslight laid on and find-your-own heating, baths extra, there was a geezer, and meals in the tomb-dark dining room with the phalanx of clotted sauce bottles in the middle of the table. Gordon, who came home for his midday dinner, paid 27 and 6 a week. The gaslight shone yellow through the frosted transom above the door of number 31. Gordon took out his key and fished about in the keyhole. In that kind of house, the key never quite fits the lock. The darkish little hallway, in reality it was only a passage, smelt of dishwater, cabbage, rag mats, and bedroom slops. Gordon glanced at the japanned tray on the hall stand. No letters, of course. He had told himself not to hope for a letter, and nevertheless had continued to hope. A stale feeling, not quite a pain, settled upon his breast. Rosemary might have written. It was 4 days now since she had written. Moreover, there were a couple of poems that he had sent out to magazines and had not yet had returned to him. The one thing that made the evening bearable was to find a letter waiting for him when he got home, but he received very few letters, 4 or 5 in a week at the very most. On the left of the hall was the never-used parlour, then came the staircase, and beyond that the passage ran down to the kitchen and to the unapproachable lair inhabited by Mrs. Wisbeach herself. As Gordon came in, the door at the end of the passage opened a foot or so. Mrs. Wisbeach's face emerged, inspected him briefly but suspiciously, and disappeared again. It was quite impossible to get in or out of the house at any time before 11 at night without being scrutinised in this manner. Just what Mrs. Wisbeach suspected you of, it was hard to say. Smuggling women into the house, possibly? She was one of those malignant, respectable women who keep lodging houses. Age about 45, stout but active, with a pink, fine-featured, horribly observant face, beautiful grey hair, and a permanent grievance. Gordon halted at the foot of the narrow stairs. Above, a coarse, rich voice was singing "Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf?" A very fat man of 38 or 39 came round the angle of the stairs, with the light, dancing step peculiar to fat men, dressed in a smart grey suit, yellow shoes, a rakish Trilby hat, and a belted blue overcoat of startling vulgarity. This was Flaxman, the first-floor lodger and travelling representative of the Queen of Sheba Toilet Requisites Company. He saluted Gordon with a lemon-coloured glove as he came down. "Hello, Chappie," he said blithely. Flaxman called everyone Chappie. "How's life with you?" "Bloody," said Gordon shortly. Flaxman had reached the bottom of the stairs. He threw a roly-poly arm affectionately round Gordon's shoulders. "Cheer up, old man, cheer up. You look like a bloody funeral. I'm off down to the Crichton. Come on down, have a quick one." "I can't. I've got to work." "Oh, hell, be matey, can't you? What's the good of mooning about up here? Come on down to the Cry and we'll pinch the barmaid's bum." Gordon wriggled free of Flaxman's arm. Like all small, frail people, he hated being touched. Flaxman merely grinned with the typical fat man's good humour. He was really horribly fat. He filled his trousers as though he had been melted and then poured into them. But of course, like other fat people, he never admitted to being fat. No fat person ever uses the word fat if there is any way of avoiding it. Stout is the word they use, or better still, robust. A fat man is never so happy as when he's describing himself as robust. Flaxman, at his first meeting with Gordon, had been on the point of calling himself robust, but something in Gordon's greenish eye had deterred him. He compromised on stout instead. "I do admit, Chappie," he said, "to being, well, just a wee bit on the stout side. Nothing unwholesome, you know." He patted the vague frontier between his belly and his chest. "Good, firm flesh. I'm pretty nippy on my feet, as a matter of fact, but, well, I suppose you might call me stout." "Like Cortez," Gordon suggested. "Cortez? Cortez? Was that the chappie who was always wandering about in the mountains in Mexico?" "That's the fella. He was stout, but he had eagle eyes." "Oh, now that's funny, because a wife said something rather like that to me once. 'George,' she said, 'you've got the most wonderful eyes in the world. You've got eyes just like an eagle,' she said. That would be before she married me, you'll understand." Flaxman was living apart from his wife at the moment. A little while back, the Queen of Sheba Toilet Requisites Company had unexpectedly paid out a bonus of £30 to all its travellers, and at the same time, Flaxman and two others had been sent across to Paris to press the new sex appeal nature tint lipstick on various French firms. Flaxman had not thought it necessary to mention the £30 to his wife. He had had the time of his life on that Paris trip, of course. Even now, 3 months afterwards, his mouth watered when he spoke of it. He used to entertain Gordon with luscious descriptions. 10 days in Paris with £30 that wife he hadn't heard about. Oh, boy, but unfortunately, there had been a leakage somewhere. Flaxman had got home to find retribution awaiting him. His wife had broken his head with a cut-glass whiskey decanter, a wedding present which they had had for 14 years, and then fled to her mother's house, taking the children with her. Hence Flaxman's exile in Willowbed Road. But he wasn't letting it worry him. It would blow over, no doubt. It had happened several times before. Gordon made another attempt to get past Flaxman and escape up the stairs. The dreadful thing was that in his heart he was pining to go with him. He needed a drink so badly the mere mention of the Crichton Arms had made him feel thirsty. But it was impossible, of course. He had no money. Flaxman put an arm across the stairs, barring his way. He was genuinely fond of Gordon. He considered him clever. Cleverness to him being a kind of amiable lunacy. Moreover, he detested being alone, even so short a time as it would take him to walk to the pub. "Come on, Chappie," he urged. "You want a Guinness to buck you up? That's what you want. You haven't seen the new girl they've got in the saloon bar yet. Oh, boy, there's a peach for you." "So that's why you're all dolled up, is it?" said Gordon, looking coldly at Flaxman's yellow gloves. "You bet it is, Chappie. Cool, what a peach. Ash blonde she is. And she knows a thing or two, that girlie does. I gave her a stick of our sex appeal nature tint last night. You ought to see her wag her little bottom at me as she went past my table. Does she give me the palpitations? Does she? Oh, boy." Flaxman wriggled lasciviously. His tongue appeared between his lips. Then, suddenly pretending that Gordon was the ash blonde barmaid, he seized him by the waist and gave him a tender squeeze. Gordon shoved him away. For a moment, the desire to go down to the Crichton Arms was so ravishing that it almost overcame him. Oh, for a pint of beer. He seemed almost to feel it going down his throat. If only he had had any money. Even sevenpence for a pint. But what was the use? Tuppence halfpenny in pocket. You can't let other people buy your drinks for you. "Oh, leave me alone, for God's sake," he said irritably, stepping out of Flaxman's reach, and went up the stairs without looking back. Flaxman settled his hat on his head and made for the front door, mildly offended. Gordon reflected dully that it was always like this nowadays. He was forever snubbing friendly advances. Of course, it was money that was at the bottom of it, always money. You can't be friendly, you can't even be civil when you have no money in your pocket. A spasm of self-pity went through him. His heart yearned for the saloon bar at the Crichton. The lovely smell of beer, the warmth and bright lights, the cheery voices, the clatter of glasses on the beer-wet bar. Money, money. He went on up the dark, evil-smelling stairs. The thought of his cold, lonely bedroom at the top of the house was like a doom before him. On the second floor lived Lorenheim, a dark, meagre, lizard-like creature of uncertain age and race who made about 35 shillings a week by touting vacuum cleaners. Gordon always went very hurriedly past Lorenheim's door. Lorenheim was one of those people who have not a single friend in the world and who are devoured by a lust for company. His loneliness was so deadly that if you so much as slowed your pace outside his door, he was liable to pounce out upon you and half drag, half wheedle you in to listen to interminable paranoid tales of girls he had seduced and employers he had scored off. And his room was more cold and squalid than even a lodging house bedroom has any right to be. There were always half-eaten bits of bread and margarine lying about everywhere. The only other lodger in the house was an engineer of some kind, employed on night work. Gordon only saw him occasionally, a massive man with a grim, discoloured face who wore a bowler hat indoors and out. In the familiar darkness of his room, Gordon felt for the gas jet and lighted it. The room was medium-sized, not big enough to be curtained into two, but too big to be sufficiently warmed by one defective oil lamp. It had the sort of furniture you expect in a top-floor back. White quilted single bed, brown lino floor covering, washhand stand with jug and basin of that cheap white ware which you can never see without thinking of chamber pots. On the windowsill there was a sickly aspidistra in a green-glazed pot. Up against this, under the window, there was a kitchen table with an ink-stained green cloth. This was Gordon's writing table. It was only after a bitter struggle that he had induced Mrs. Wisbeach to give him a kitchen table instead of the bamboo occasional table, a mere stand for the aspidistra, which she considered proper for a top-floor back. And even now there was endless nagging because Gordon would never allow his table to be tidied up. The table was in a permanent mess. It was almost covered with a muddle of papers, perhaps 200 sheets of sermon paper, grimy and dog-eared, and all written on and crossed out and written on again, a sort of sordid labyrinth of papers to which only Gordon possessed the key. There was a film of dust over everything, and there were several foul little trays containing tobacco ash and the twisted stubs of cigarettes. Except for a few books on the mantelpiece, this table, with its mess of papers, was the sole mark Gordon's personality had left on the room. It was beastly cold. Gordon thought he would light the oil lamp. He lifted it. It felt very light. The spare oil can also was empty. No oil till Friday. He applied a match. A dull yellow flame crept unwillingly round the wick. It might burn for a couple of hours with any luck. As Gordon threw away the match, his eye fell upon the aspidistra in its grass-green pot. It was a peculiarly mangy specimen. It had only 7 leaves, and never seemed to put forth any new ones. Gordon had a sort of secret feud with the aspidistra. Many a time he had furtively attempted to kill it, starving it of water, grinding hot cigarette ends against its stem, even mixing salt with its earth. But the beastly things are practically immortal. In almost any circumstances, they can preserve a wilting, diseased existence. Gordon stood up and deliberately wiped his kerosene-y fingers on the aspidistra leaves. At this moment, Mrs. Wisbeach's voice rang shrewishly up the stairs.
"Mr. Comstock?"
Gordon went to the door.
"Yes," he called down. "Your supper's been waiting for you this 10 minutes. Why can't you come down and have it instead of keeping me waiting for the washing up?"
Gordon went down. The dining room was on the first floor at the back, opposite Flaxman's room. It was a cold, close-smelling room, twilit even at midday.
There were more aspidistras in it than Gordon had ever accurately counted. They were all over the place, on the sideboard, on the floor, on occasional tables. In the window there was a sort of florist's stand of them blocking out the light. In the half-darkness, with aspidistras all about you, you had the feeling of being in some sunless aquarium amid the dreary foliage of waterflowers. Gordon's supper was set out, waiting for him, in the circle of white light that the cracked gas jet cast upon the tablecloth. He sat down with his back to the fireplace. There was an aspidistra in the grate instead of a fire, and ate his plate of cold beef and his two slices of crumbly white bread with Canadian butter, mousetrap cheese and panyan pickle, and drank a glass of cold but musty water. When he went back to his room, the oil lamp had got going more or less. It was hot enough to boil a kettle by, he thought, and now for the great event of the evening, his illicit cup of tea. He made himself a cup of tea almost every night in the deadliest secrecy. Mrs. Wisbeach refused to give her lodgers tea with their supper because she couldn't be bothered with hotting up extra water, but at the same time making tea on your bedroom was strictly forbidden. Gordon looked with disgust at the muddled papers on the table. He told himself defiantly that he wasn't going to do any work tonight. He would have a cup of tea and smoke up his remaining cigarettes and read King Lear or Sherlock Holmes. His books were on the mantelpiece beside the alarm clock. Shakespeare in the Everyman edition, Sherlock Holmes, Villon's poems, Roderick Random, Les Fleurs du Mal, a pile of French novels. But he read nothing nowadays except Shakespeare and Sherlock Holmes. Meanwhile, that cup of tea. Gordon went to the door, pushed it ajar, and listened. No sound of Mrs. Wisbeach. He had to be very careful. She was quite capable of sneaking upstairs and catching you in the act. This tea-making was the major household offence, next to bringing a woman in. Quietly he bolted the door, dragged his cheap suitcase from under the bed, and unlocked it. From it he extracted a sixpenny Woolworth's kettle, a packet of Lyons tea, a tin of condensed milk, a teapot, and a cup. They were all packed in newspaper to prevent them from chinking. He had his regular procedure for making tea. First, he half-filled the kettle with water from the jug and set it on the oil stove. Then he knelt down and spread out a piece of newspaper. Yesterday's tea leaves were still in the pot, of course. He shook them out onto the newspaper, cleaned out the pot with his thumb, and folded the leaves into a bundle. Presently he would smuggle them downstairs. That was always the most risky part, getting rid of the used tea leaves. It was like the difficulty murderers have in disposing of the body. As for the cup, he always washed it in his hand basin in the morning. A squalid business. It sickened him sometimes. It was queer how furtively you had to live in Mrs. Wisbeach's house. He had the feeling that she was always watching you. And indeed she was given to tiptoeing up and downstairs at all hours in hope of catching the lodgers up to mischief. It was one of those houses where you cannot even go to the WC in peace because of the feeling that somebody is listening to you. Gordon unbolted the door again and listened intently. No one stirring. Ah! A clatter of crockery far below. Mrs. Wisbeach was washing up the supper things, probably safe to go down then. He tiptoed down, clutching the damp bundle of tea leaves against his breast. The WC was on the second floor. At the angle of the stairs he halted, listened a moment longer. Ah, another clatter of crockery. All clear. Gordon Comstock, poet of exceptional promise, the Times Lit Sup had said, hurriedly slipped into the WC, flung his tea leaves down the waste pipe, and pulled the plug. Then he hurried back to his room, rebolted the door, and, with precautions against noise, brewed himself a fresh pot of tea. The room was passably warm by now. The tea and a cigarette worked their short-lived magic. He began to feel a little less bored and angry. Should he do a spot of work after all?
He ought to work, of course. He always hated himself afterwards when he had wasted a whole evening. Half unwillingly, he shoved his chair up to the table. It needed an effort even to disturb that frightful jungle of papers. He pulled a few grimy sheets towards him, spread them out, and looked at them. God, what a mess. Written on, scored out, written over, scored out again, till they were like poor old hacked cancer patients after 20 operations. But the handwriting, where it was not crossed out, was delicate and scholarly. With pain and trouble, Gordon had acquired that scholarly hand, so different from the beastly copperplate they had taught him at school. Perhaps he would work, for a little while, anyway. He rummaged in the litter of papers. Where was that passage he had been working on yesterday? The poem was an immensely long one. That is, it was going to be immensely long when it was finished. 2,000 lines or so, in rhyme royal, describing a day in London. London Pleasures, its name was. It was a huge, ambitious project. The kind of thing that should only be undertaken by people with endless leisure. Gordon had not grasped that fact when he began the poem. He grasped it now, however. How light-heartedly he had begun it 2 years ago, when he had chucked up everything and descended into the slime of poverty. The conception of this poem had been at least a part of his motive. He had felt so certain then that he was equal to it, but somehow, almost from the start, London Pleasures had gone wrong. It was too big for him, that was the truth. It had never really progressed. It had simply fallen apart into a series of fragments. And out of 2 years' work, that was all that he had to show. Just fragments, incomplete in themselves and impossible to join together. On every one of those sheets of paper there was some hacked scrap of verse which had been written and rewritten and rewritten over intervals of months. There were not 500 lines that you could say were definitely finished, and he had lost the power to add to it any longer. He could only tinker with this passage or that, groping now here, now there in its confusion. It was no longer a thing that he created, it was merely a nightmare with which he struggled. For the rest, in 2 whole years, he had produced nothing except a handful of short poems, perhaps a score in all. It was so rarely that he could attain the peace of mind in which poetry, or prose for that matter, has got to be written. The times when he could not work grew commoner and commoner. Of all types of human being, only the artist takes it upon him to say that he cannot work. But it is quite true. There are times when one cannot work. Money again. Always money. Lack of money means discomfort, means squalid worries, means shortage of tobacco, means ever-present consciousness of failure. Above all, it means loneliness. How can you be anything but lonely on 2 quid a week? And in loneliness, no decent book was ever written. It was quite certain that London Pleasures would never be the poem he had conceived. It was quite certain, indeed, that it would never even be finished. And in the moments when he faced facts, Gordon himself was aware of this. Yet all the same, and all the more for that very reason, he went on with it. It was something to cling to. It was a way of hitting back at his poverty and his loneliness. And after all, there were times when the mood of creation returned, or seemed to return. It returned tonight, for just a little while, just as long as it takes to smoke 2 cigarettes. With smoke tickling his lungs, he abstracted himself from the mean and actual world. He drove his mind into the abyss where poetry is written. The gas jet sang soothingly overhead. Words became vivid and momentous things. A couplet written a year ago and left as finished caught his eye with a note of doubt. He repeated it to himself over and over. It was wrong, somehow. It had seemed all right a year ago. Now, on the other hand, it seemed subtly vulgar. He rummaged among the sheets of foolscap till he found one that had nothing written on the back, turned it over, wrote the couplet out anew, wrote a dozen different versions of it, and repeated each of them over and over to himself. Finally, there was none that satisfied him. The couplet would have to go. It was cheap and vulgar. He
He found the original sheet of paper and scored the couplet out with thick lines, and in doing this, there was a sense of achievement, of time not wasted, as though the destruction of much labour were in some way an act of creation. Gordon started. His mind fled upwards from the abyss, the post. London pleasures was forgotten. His heart fluttered. Perhaps Rosemary had written. Besides, there were those two poems he had sent to the magazines. One of them, indeed, he had almost given up as lost. He had sent it to an American paper, the Californian Review, months ago. Probably they wouldn't even bother to send it back. But the other was with an English paper, the Primrose Quarterly. He had wild hopes of that one. The Primrose Quarterly was one of those poisonous literary papers in which the fashionable Nancy boy and the professional Roman Catholic walk bras dessous. It was also, by a long way, the most influential literary paper in England. You were a made man once you had a poem in it. In his heart, Gordon knew that the Primrose Quarterly would never print his poems. He wasn't up to their standard. Still, miracles sometimes happen, or if not miracles, accidents. After all, they'd had his poem 6 weeks. Would they keep it 6 weeks if they didn't mean to accept it? He tried to quell the insane hope. But at the worst, there was a chance that Rosemary had written. It was 4 whole days since she had written. She wouldn't do it, perhaps, if she knew how it disappointed him. Her letters, long, ill-spelt letters, full of absurd jokes and protestations of love for him, meant far more to him than she could ever understand. They were a reminder that there was still somebody in the world who cared for him. They even made up for the times when some beast had sent back one of his poems. And, as a matter of fact, the magazines always did send back his poems, except Antichrist, whose editor, Ravelston, was his personal friend. There was shuffling below. It was always some minutes before Mrs. Wisbeach brought the letters upstairs. She liked to paw them about, feel them to see how thick they were, read their postmarks, hold them up to the light and speculate on their contents before yielding them to their rightful owners. She exercised a sort of droit de seigneur over letters. Coming to her house, they were, she felt, at least partially hers. If you had gone to the front door and collected your own letters, she would have resented it, bitterly. On the other hand, she also resented the labour of carrying them upstairs. You would hear her footsteps very slowly ascending, and then, if there was a letter for you, there would be loud, aggrieved breathing on the landing, this to let you know that you had put Mrs. Wisbeach out of breath by dragging her up all those stairs. Finally, with a little impatient grunt, the letters would be shoved under your door. Mrs. Wisbeach was coming up the stairs. Gordon listened. The footsteps paused on the first floor. A letter for Flaxman. They ascended, paused again on the second floor. A letter for the engineer. Gordon's heart beat painfully. A letter, please God, a letter. More footsteps. Ascending or descending? They were coming nearer, surely. Oh, no, no, the sound grew fainter. She was going down again. The footsteps died away. No letters. He took up his pen again. It was a quite futile gesture. She hadn't written after all, the little beast. He had not the smallest intention of doing any more work. Indeed, he could not. The disappointment had taken all the heart out of him. Only 5 minutes ago his poem had still seemed to him a living thing. Now he knew it unmistakably for the worthless tripe that it was. With a kind of nervous disgust, he bundled the scattered sheets together, stacked them in an untidy heap, and dumped them on the other side of the table, under the aspidistra. He could not even bear to look at them any longer. He got up. It was too early to go to bed. At least, he was not in the mood for it. He pined for a bit of amusement, something cheap and easy, a seat in the pictures, cigarettes, beer. Useless. No money to pay for any of them. He would read King Lear and forget this filthy century. Finally, however, it was the Adventures of Sherlock Holmes that he took from the mantelpiece. Sherlock Holmes was his favourite of all books, because he knew it by heart. The oil in the lamp was giving out, and it was getting beastly cold. Gordon dragged the quilt from his bed, wrapped it round his legs, and sat down to read. His right elbow on the table, his hands under his coat to keep them warm, he read through The Adventure of the Speckled Band. The little gas mantle sighed above. The circular flame of the oil lamp burned low, a thin bracelet of fire, giving out no more heat than a candle. Down in Mrs. Wisbeach's lair, the clock struck 10:30. You could always hear it striking at night. Ping, 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 a note of doom. The ticking of the alarm clock on the mantelpiece became audible to Gordon again, bringing with it the consciousness of the sinister passage of time. He looked about him. Another evening wasted. Hours, days, years slipping by, night after night, always the same. The lonely room, the womanless bed, dust, cigarette ash, the aspidistra leaves. And he was 30, nearly. In sheer self-punishment, he dragged forth a wad of London pleasures, spread out the grimy sheets, and looked at them as one looks at a skull for a memento mori. London Pleasures, by Gordon Comstock, author of Mice. His magnum opus. The fruit indeed, of 2 years' work, that labyrinthine mess of words. And tonight's achievement? Two lines crossed out. Two lines backward instead of forward. The lamp made a sound like a tiny hiccup and went out. With an effort, Gordon stood up and flung the quilt back onto his bed. Better get to bed, perhaps, before it got any colder. He wandered over towards the bed. But wait. Work tomorrow. Wind the clock, set the alarm. Nothing accomplished, nothing done has earned a night's repose. It was some time before he could find the energy to undress. For a quarter of an hour, perhaps, he lay on the bed fully dressed, his hands under his head. There was a crack on the ceiling that resembled the map of Australia. Gordon contrived to work off his shoes and socks without sitting up. He held up one foot and looked at it. A smallish, delicate foot. Ineffectual, like his hands. Also, it was very dirty. It was nearly 10 days since he had had a bath. Becoming ashamed of the dirtiness of his feet, he sagged into a sitting position and undressed himself, throwing his clothes onto the floor. Then he turned up the gas and slid between the sheets, shuddering, for he was naked. He always slept naked. His last suit of pyjamas had gone west more than a year ago. The clock downstairs struck 11. As the first coldness of the sheets wore off, Gordon's mind went back to the poem he had begun that afternoon. He repeated in a whisper the single stanza that was finished. Sharply the menacing wind sweeps over the bending poplars newly bare, and the dark ribbons of the chimneys veer downward, flicked by whips of air, torn posters flutter. The octosyllables flicked to and fro, click, 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 click. The awful, mechanical emptiness of it appalled him. It was like some futile little machine ticking over, rhyme to rhyme, click, 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 like the nodding of a clockwork doll. Poetry, the last futility. He lay awake, aware of his own futility, of his 30 years, of the blind alley into which he had led his life. The clock struck 12. Gordon had stretched his legs out straight. The bed had grown warm and comfortable. The upturned beam of a car, somewhere in the street parallel to Willowbed Road, penetrated the blind, and threw into silhouette a leaf of the aspidistra, shaped like Agamemnon's sword.